From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from University of Michigan, Ann Arbor.
Today, Spain came to a grinding stop and held 5 minutes of silence to observe the one-year anniversary of the Madrid bombings in what people here in Spain call our September 11th.
It's a day of mourning in Spain to mark the March 11th train bombings. We'll go to Madrid to get a report. Then an in-depth look at the Middle East with two guests here in Michigan. Osama Siblani, the editor of the Arab American in Dearborn, and Professor Juan Cole of the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, talking about the latest from Syria to Lebanon to Iraq.
The bombing in the Shiite mosque at Mosul was horrific and appears to have targeted a group of devotees of the radical preacher Muqtada Sadr.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we are broadcasting from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Spain has entered a day of mourning to mark the first anniversary of the March 11th train bombings in Madrid that killed 191 people and injured more than 1,800. Earlier today at 7:37 local time, bells tolled from Madrid's 650 churches, ringing for 5 minutes to mark the first of the 10 blasts that hit a year ago. We'll go to Madrid to get a report after headlines. In Iraq, the main Shiite and Kurdish coalitions have struck a deal to form a new government when the National Assembly convenes next week. The agreement will allow Jalal Talabani to become Iraq's first ever Kurdish president and for discussions to begin on allowing 100,000 Kurds to return to the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Under the power-sharing agreement, the country's Sunni Arab minority will be given one ministerial post. In other Iraq news, 50 people died on Thursday after a suicide bomber attacked a funeral in Mosul of a respected Shiite professor. The suicide bomber reportedly walked into a large crowd at the funeral and detonated his explosive belt. The death toll may rise even higher. Several children who are attending the funeral are reported to be missing. And President Bush has named Zalmay Khalilzad to become the new ambassador to Iraq. Khalilzad is currently serving as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He'll take the post from John Negroponte, who has been nominated to become the country's first director of national intelligence. The New York Times is reporting the Pentagon is considering transferring hundreds of detainees being held at Guantanamo Bay to foreign prisons in Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The proposal comes as the Bush administration is reconsidering its use of the military base in Cuba, that has been criticized by the Supreme Court and human rights groups. The White House originally embraced using Guantanamo in part because the base was seen as beyond the jurisdiction of U.S. law. But last year, the Supreme Court ruled that prisoners there could challenge their detentions in federal court. In part because of that ruling, the Pentagon has not transferred any new prisoner to Guantanamo in 6 months. The prison currently holds about 540 men. Senate Democrats are criticizing a new Pentagon investigation for concluding that the abuses committed by U.S. soldiers at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere were not the result of high-level policy decisions. Democrats accuse the report's author, Vice Admiral Albert Church, of not investigating the role played by top Pentagon officials. According to the Washington Post, Church did not interview Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld or any other top official. Senator Carl Levin also criticized Church for failing to examine the role played by the CIA. The agency hid detainees from the Red Cross and carried out the secret renditions of wanted individuals to countries with records of torture. Republican James Talent of Missouri praised the report. He said he did not, quote, need an investigation to tell me there was no comprehensive or systematic use of inhumane tactics by the American military because those guys and gals just wouldn't do it, he said. But Reed Brody of Human Rights Watch said, quote, the report strains credibility. Unfortunately, the United States continues to do what every dictatorship and banana republic does when its abuses are discovered, cover up and shift blame downwards. The American Civil Liberties Union repeated its call for the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate the widespread reports of abuse. In news on Capitol Hill, the Senate has approved an overhaul of the nation's bankruptcy laws in a move that will make it harder for Americans to rid themselves of debt by filing for bankruptcy. The law changes had been sought by the banking and credit card industries for the past decade. The House is expected to approve the measure next month. President Bush has vowed to sign the bill. Democrats unsuccessfully sought to soften the bill's impact on single parents, the unemployed, and people facing large medical bills. This news on Syria. A United Nations envoy is being sent to Damascus tomorrow to warn President Bashar Assad that Syria will face political and economic isolation if he does not completely and quickly withdraw from Lebanon. According to The Washington Post, the U.S., Europe, and the Arab League have all supported the move. The envoy is expected to tell Assad he must honor the independent sovereignty of Lebanon and provide a complete timeline for a pullout of troops and intelligence agents in Lebanon. In New York, a federal judge has dismissed a class action lawsuit concerning the use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. A group of Vietnamese citizens had accused U.S. chemical companies, including Dow and Monsanto, of committing war crimes by supplying the military with the chemical agent. During the war, the U.S. military sprayed over 3,000 Vietnamese villages with Agent Orange, affecting between 2 and 5 million people. In other legal news, the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington will hear arguments today in a case against Henry Kissinger. The former Secretary of State has been accused of conspiring with military officials in Chile to assassinate a Chilean general named René Schneider in 1970. Schneider's death paved the way for the 1971 military coup led by General Augusto Pinochet. Schneider's sons brought the suit against Kissinger, claiming that declassified government documents show Kissinger's complicity in their father's death. Last year, a lower court threw out the case, but the appeals court will hear arguments today on whether the civil suit should go forward. That coup in 1973. In Nashville, Tennessee, 30 Muslims from Somalia have been fired for their jobs at a plant run by Dell Computer. The Muslims had insisted they be allowed to take a break from work at sunset to say their daily prayers. Since the time of sunset changes daily, the workers wanted the flexibility to take breaks at different times. The Council on American-Islamic Relations has called on Dell to rehire the workers. In news from Capitol Hill, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus are withholding their party membership dues in protest. According to the newspaper The Hill, the decision was the culmination of several years of frustration with what they view as the Democratic Party's failure to reach out to Latinos and include them in the decision-making process. In other news from Capitol Hill, lawmakers led by independent Vermont Congressmember Bernie Sanders and Democratic Congresswoman Barbara Lee have introduced the Freedom to Read Protection Act. The legislation would exempt libraries and booksellers from provisions of the USA Patriot Act that allow the federal government to access library or bookstore records without having to get a traditional search warrant. Over 100 members of Congress have co-sponsored the bill. And two retired New York City police detectives have been arrested for taking part in 8 murders on behalf of the mafia. Prosecutors say while the two men were working as NYPD detectives, the men were also on the mafia payroll and routinely funneled secret information about criminal investigations to other members of organized crime. Louis Appolito and Stephen Caracappa were arrested Thursday in Las Vegas. In one case in 1990, prosecutors said the detectives, driving an unmarked police car, pulled over a mafia captain in Brooklyn and shot him to death for a rival mob figure. In another, in 1986, they flashed their badges and kidnapped a mobster, threw him in the trunk of their car, and delivered him to a rival who tortured and killed him. This is Democracy Now! We are broadcasting from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm Amy Goodman. Across Spain today, people are marking the first anniversary of the March 11th Madrid train bombings that killed 191 people and left 1,800 people wounded. Some 650 churches throughout the Madrid area rang their bells for 5 minutes at 7:37 a.m. local time. The time that 10 bombs began exploding on four packed trains in what Spaniards refer to as our September 11th. The explosions came 3 days before a general election in which the socialists headed by José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero ousted the right-wing Popular Party of then Prime Minister José María Aznar. Responsibility for the attack was claimed by a Moroccan cell with links to al-Qaeda. Most of those who've been arrested are Moroccan citizens. Meanwhile, Muslim clerics in Spain issued what they called the world's first fatwa, or edict, against Osama bin Laden, urging other Muslims to denounce the al-Qaeda leader. The ruling was issued by the Islamic Commission of Spain, the main body representing the country's 1 million Muslims. We go now to Spain to speak with independent journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent Maria Carrion. She joins us on the line from Madrid. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Maria.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what happened in Spain today?
Well, I think the tone was set today for the commemoration by the Association of the Family Members and Victims of March 11th bombings. And its head, its president, Pilar Manjón, who lost a son in one of the trains, basically made a call for peace, for nonviolent resolution of conflicts, against all wars and against all sorts of political and religious fundamentalism. And I think that was that really has been sort of the tone that they have been setting from the very beginning, from last March 11th. And I think before talking about what has happened since in terms of today's commemorations and the large summit that just took place in Madrid on terrorism, it's really interesting to note that this past year has been very, very different from the year that followed the September 11th attacks in the United States. We in Spain have not seen a passage of a sort of a Patriot Act type of law. We've not had any alerts, orange alerts or yellow alerts. There's been no mass hysteria in the media talking about, new attacks and about having to attack other countries. We've had no massive indiscriminate arrests of Arabs or Moroccan citizens. And as a matter of fact, the first act of Spaniards, basically after tending to the victims, tending to the wounded, was to toss out a pro-war government, a government that had sent troops to Iraq and that had stood with President Bush in the Azores calling for war. And the first act of the socialists when they came to power was to withdraw troops, Spanish troops from Iraq. So basically, I think that what we're seeing here is a sort of an alternative vision of how to deal with terrorism that first calls for a look at ourselves and whether we have fomented from the West some of these, some of this hatred that leads to these kinds of attacks. Having said that, I can tell you that, it's a very somber day here today. It's being marked by, aside from the events that you mentioned, the planting of 191 suppressed trees and olive trees in a park here in Madrid, and this is an act presided over the King and Queen of Spain and also the King of Morocco. Many of the people arrested, as you mentioned, in the attacks were Moroccan citizens, and so he wanted to be here for that. We had 5 minutes of silence at noon. Spain is a very noisy country, and Madrid is an extremely noisy city, and it was incredible how everything came to a screeching halt at 12 noon, and everybody just paused for a few minutes to, commemorate, to think about the dead and the injured. There's also an interesting development here. We've had families of September 11th victims for Peaceful Tomorrow. They've come to Madrid to hold hands with the families of those killed and those injured in the attacks here in Madrid. So they were here to share their experiences, and they held a vigil for the victims and also against the war just a few days ago. So there's much going on here. And, of course, on an official level, we've had a couple of things happen. One is the closure of the March 11th Commission. And Democracy Now! Interviewed one of the members of the commission when you were here, Amy. You interviewed one of them. And basically, they've issued their recommendations, and they have been approved by the entire commission except members of the PP, which is the conservative party that was in power when the attacks happened. And the PP has held its support because they believe that there is a link between the attacks and ETA, the Basque separatist group. This is something that has been rejected by both the investigators, the prosecutors in the case, but PP wants to hold to that theory, so they do not accept this document. Today, the Spanish government also took the document and approved measures, assistance for victims, and the other measures that are recommended by the commission. We've also seen some other conclusions come out of these investigations. We've had, 75 arrests so far, mostly Moroccan citizens, and 23 remain in jail. We've had one conviction, that of a juvenile from Spain who was accused of being the go-between between those who were selling explosives and those buying the explosives that were placed in the trains. And then, of course, seven presumed attackers committed a collective suicide when they were surrounded by police weeks after the attack. So that happened April 4th of last year. Aside from that, another clear conclusion coming out of the prosecutors is that there was definitely a link between Spain's initial support and involvement in the war in Iraq and the attacks. We saw a lot of threats being issued by Al-Qaeda when Spain joined in with the United States. And one of the conclusions also is that the Spanish government neglected to take measures, concrete measures, with the information that they had through informants that these sales of dynamite were taking place and that suspected members of Qaeda were purchasing the dynamite. And there's a sense here that the government was downplaying the risks because it didn't want to be perceived as being a target because of its involvement in the war. So that may have led to some neglect on the part of investigators before the attacks. Nobody
and of course
avoided. Sorry.
Of course, Maria, for people who don't remember, at that time, the first target of the Aznar government was ETA, saying that the bombing was done by ETA.
Precisely. And really, it was more the government manipulation of information that led to their being tossed out of power. Basically, for 3 days, even though the first day right after the attacks, just hours after the attacks, the police found an abandoned vehicle at one of the station that one of the trains had left from, and that car had detonators that coincided with those used in the attack, as well as a tape of Quranic verses. And it was very quickly on, the police adopted the theory that it wasn't ETA and that it was probably Al-Qaeda. And even though, very soon after that, they made the first arrests of Moroccan citizens tied to Qaeda, the Spanish government, in all of its appearances before the press, continued to insist that ETA was the first and main suspect of the investigation, to the point where the day before the elections there were mass protests across Spain in front of the PP headquarters demanding to know the truth, people demanding to be told the truth about who did this or who is being investigated as the number one suspect. And the day after that was the day that the PP was tossed from power.
Well, Maria, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Maria Carrion joining us from Madrid, Spain, on this first anniversary of the March 11th train bombings. This is Democracy Now! When we return, we'll be joined by two people here in Michigan, as we broadcast from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, talking about the situation in the Middle East and also the situation for Arabs and Arab Americans here at home. We'll be joined by Professor Juan Cole, and we'll also be joined by the publisher of The Arab American, based in Dearborn, Michigan, here in Michigan, where it's home to one of the largest Arab populations in this country. Stay with us.
Today's a day of disaster. I'm on the sandbar. All known people pass by. It's only my cousin that I call as he goes to buy cigarettes and bread. Through the glass, women look on their shoulders. They should be doing something else in these times. But I'm sorry, it's the best I can do. Couples speak about their past, and it's hard to speak without anger this time. Yeah, it's very hard to speak without anger.
Last Fool in Town by the Spanish group Migala here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we broadcast on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV, as well as PBS stations, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're also video and audio streaming at democracynow.org, and are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. We're broadcasting from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, home to the first anti-war teach-in 40 years ago this month. Also, the region surrounded by Dearborn and Detroit, home to one of the largest Arab communities in the United States. Today, we spend the rest of the hour looking at issues surrounding the Middle East in terms of U.S. foreign policy, as well as here at home, and how Arab Americans and Arab immigrants have been affected by the Bush administration's so-called war on terror. We're joined by two guests here in our Ann Arbor studios. Juan Cole, professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, runs an analytical website called Informed Comment, in which he provides a daily roundup of news and events in Iraq and elsewhere in the Arab world. Juan Cole speaks fluent Arabic and Farsi, has lived all over the Muslim world for extended periods of time. We are also joined by Osama Siblani. He's the publisher and editor-in-chief of The Arab American, a Dearborn-based weekly bilingual newspaper. He helped found the Arab American Political Action Committee in Dearborn and the Congress of Arab American Organizations, also affiliated with the Arab American and Chaldean Council, one of the major Arab American human service organizations in the country. Osama Siblani's influence extends abroad, and he has met several Middle East leaders, including the Syrian President Bashar Assad and the Lebanese President Emil Lahoud. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's a pleasure to see Juan Cole in person. As you know, we have often had him on Democracy Now!, but on the telephone, and to meet Osama Siblani for the first time. I wanted to start with Professor Cole. We just got a report from Madrid. Can you talk about who it is believed is responsible for the March 11th bombings?
Well, the group is a Salafi al-Jihadiya. It's a small group that was founded initially in Tangier at a mosque around a man named Sheikh Fazazi, which gathered steam and then was responsible for a set of bombings in Casablanca the year before the Madrid bombings. It established itself also in Europe, made contacts outside the Moroccan community with some Egyptian and other activists who had shadowy links with al-Qaeda, and undertook the Madrid bombing. It's a very disturbing development because this is really a local group. It has its roots in Tangier, and it morphed into a kind of franchise of al-Qaeda. We're not sure exactly how closely it came into contact with that organization. And it is in this regard typical of the new situation that we now face with regard to some of these terrorist groups.
What about the Muslim clerics issuing this fatwa, this edict against Osama bin Laden?
Well, the Muslim clerics in the Muslim world have long stood against bin Laden. This is not actually a new development. The Sheikh al-Azhar, the foremost authority in the Sunni Muslim world in Cairo, Egypt, has issued condemnations of September 11th. And of acts of aggression of that sort. Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who is Muslim, old-style Muslim Brotherhood in Qatar, very influential, has denounced bin Laden. So, in fact, this is in line with the general opinion in most of the Muslim world that bin Laden is has departed from Islamic norms by attacking innocent civilians in this way.
Now turning to Iraq, the latest bombing in Mosul, the significance of this and what happened.
Well, it's one of a series of bombings that has targeted the Shiite Muslims of Iraq. The Shiites are the majority. They have now come to power in the recent elections. The Sunni Arab minority has not reconciled itself on the whole to the new situation, and there are elements within it who are attempting to foment civil war, civil disturbance between Shiites and Sunnis as a way of destabilizing the country. And they hope that if they can destabilize the country, expel the U.S. Troops, they can then kill the new political class, assassinate it, and make a coup. So probably the people behind this are either radical Muslim groups or old-style Ba'ath military intelligence. Mm-hmm.
And the latest news about what's happening around the formation of the new government, what is being decided on March 16th?
Well, the elections brought the Shiites to power in Iraq pretty decisively. They have probably about 54% of the seats in parliament, the religious Shiite parties. And, however, you need two-thirds to form a government, according to the interim constitution. So they needed to get 66%, and the easy place to get that extra number of seats was from the Kurdish alliance, which did very well in the elections as well, much beyond their proportion of the population. And so this is a natural kind of alliance within the rules of parliament as they're now set in Iraq. And it's actually a good sign, because only if the Shiite political parties and the Kurdish ones can come to a set of compromises and agreements about the future of the country with regard to federalism, the place of religious law, the disposition of the oil city of Kirkuk, and other such issues, can we hope for a peaceful, united Iraq in the future.
Professor Juan Cole, you wrote an informed comment on Wednesday. The simplistic master narrative constructed by the partisans of President George W. Bush held that the January 30th elections were a huge success and signaled a turn to democracy in the Middle East. Then the anti-Syrian demonstrations were interpreted as a yearning for democracy inspired by the Iraqi elections. This interpretation is a gross misunderstanding of the situation in the Middle East. I'd like first you to explain this, and then I'd like a comment from Osama Sablani.
Well, the whole narrative is a little bizarre. The Lebanese have been having parliamentary elections for decades and were among the few to have fairly upright such elections at some points in the 20th century in the Arab world. So they haven't learned anything from the Iraqi elections. In fact, the elections in Iraq were a mixture of the sublime and the ridiculous. I mean, it was a wonderful thing. People came out and risked their lives to vote, but they didn't know the names of the candidates that they were voting for because of the poor security conditions, and the country had to be locked down for 3 days, no vehicular traffic at all in the entire country in order to prevent car bombings so that the elections could be held. So I think most urbane, sophisticated Beirutis would have looked upon this process in Iraq with a little bit of pity, and there's nothing inspiring there for them. They already had elections in their country scheduled for May. What happened in Lebanon was local, and I think we're going to see a lot of this. Everything that happens in the Middle East from now on is going to be pegged to the Bush administration, regardless of whether the Bush administration had anything to do with it. But there's now, I think, a political struggle inside Lebanon between those groups, especially the Christian Maronites, the Druze, and a section of the Sunnis who want an early end to the Syrian military occupation and an end to overweening Syrian influence in Lebanese politics on the one hand, and then Hezbollah and the generality of the Shiite community, I think, as well as another section of the Sunni community that actually wants the Syrians to continue to play a role.
Professor Juan Cole is here at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, also joining us, having driven in from Dearborn, about a 45-minute drive. We're joined by Osama Sablani, who is the publisher and editor-in-chief of The Arab American. I want to welcome you as well.
Thank you, Amy.
You are Lebanese-American.
That's correct.
When did you come here?
I came here in 1976. Actually, I was there about a couple of weeks ago.
And
when Hariri was assassinated, I was like about 300 meters away from him.
And what did you do then? What happened? The explosion?
Oh, yeah. I heard the explosion. Actually, we had glass where I was. You know, the whole glass just shattered over the people who were sitting, and I was away from the windows. You know, actually, my chair just jumped like a couple of feet. So, and I saw him just maybe 10, 15 minutes earlier, and we were supposed to meet with him the next day. Yes, I was in Lebanon, and I just stressed my case. I think the professor made a very good presentation and reflective of the situation in Lebanon. and in the Arab world. And yes, he is right that Lebanese have had elections since 1948 in the 50s. And every 4 years they had them. And after the civil war in 1992, and then in 1996, and then in 2000, and now they're having them again. It's a parliamentary election, and it's not, you know, democratic 100%, but it's much better than what happened in Iraq, for example. And also in Palestine, you know, that Mr. Bush is trying to claim credit for the election. There was an election in Palestine and the occupied territory 7 years ago. They elected the council, the Palestine National Council, and also they elected president at that time was Yasser Arafat. So nothing really new is happening in the Middle East that the Bush administration could take credit for it. And I think the situation in Iraq, the election in Iraq was something made for television, for American audience. So Mr. Bush can claim credit for something that he really does not deserve. And yes, you can't fight, you know, back and say, you know, what's happening in Iraq is not a step forward in democracy. It's much better, you know, to have people have the right to vote under these circumstances rather than having dictatorship run by a brutal dictator like Saddam Hussein. But again, the situation in Iraq is not about democracy. I met with the president, and he wanted to go to Iraq to search for weapons of mass destruction, and he considered the regime an imminent and gathering threat against the United States.
You met with the president of the United States?
Yes, and he was running for election in May of 2000 when he was a governor. He told me just straight in my face among 12 or maybe 13 Republicans at that time here in Michigan at a hotel. I think it's in May 17th, 2000, even before he became the nominee for the Republicans. He told me that he was going to take him out when we talked about Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I said, well, you know, I totally disagree with you. You just can't go around taking leaders out of their countries, you know. Let the Iraqi people do it. They can't do it on empty stomach. Lift sanctions. Keep the pressure on Saddam Hussein, but lift the sanctions on the Iraqi people. People can't make moves on empty stomach. And once they start establishing, you know, a connection with the United States and helping democracy inside, they will overthrow him. And then he said, we have to talk about it later. But at that time, he was not privy to any intelligence. And the Democrats have occupied the White House for the previous 8 years. So he was not privy to any intelligence whatsoever. He was not the official nominee of the Republican Party, so he didn't know what kind of situation the weapons of mass destruction was at that time. But what I am saying now is the president is trying to claim credit for something that really had nothing to do with him. The Palestinians had elections 7 years ago. They've had election last month. And also the Lebanese, what the professor said, that this is a situation that is happening in Lebanon because there is a formula in Lebanon that always Lebanon, part of the Lebanese communities, try to get help from the outside in order to gain more power and bring more cards to the table for bargaining.
What about the situation right now in Lebanon with the president, who you have met with, the Lebanese president, Lahoud, reappointing the Syrian-backed prime minister?
Well, there is no doubt that Syrian influence is all over Lebanon. But the Syrians have been there to work out with the Lebanese the details of the Taif Accord that was signed back in 1989. And that ended the civil war in Lebanon. Definitely, the Syrians have made mistakes. Definitely, the Syrians are interfering into the, you know, the Lebanese situation in little details. And the president Bashar Assad, who I've met also, admit to the mistakes that the Syrians have made in Lebanon. And the Syrians should get out of Lebanon and pull their security forces. And most of the Lebanese would agree. Now, some of the Lebanese, I would say the minority, would like to see the Syrians humiliated on the way out. Others, which is the majority in Lebanon, like to see them out leaving with dignity and keeping the relationship between Lebanon and Syria. If you look at the geography where Lebanon is, it's between Israel and Syria and the Mediterranean. So the only really breathing space that Lebanon has to the world is through Syria. So we can't really have a bad situation and bad relationship and bad blood between the Syrian and the Lebanese. That will create more trouble, especially that we have already a bad situation with the Israelis.
We're talking to Osama Siblani. He is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Arab American, which is a weekly bilingual newspaper in the United States here in the heart of Arab America. We're also joined by Juan Cole, professor at the University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor. This is Democracy Now! We'll come back with them in a minute. Upper Peninsula by Sufjan Stevens here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're having a conversation about the Middle East and also want to talk about the Arab American community here in the United States. So we're joined by Professor Juan Cole. You've heard him on the telephone. Now we're in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan, where he is a professor of modern Middle East history. We're also joined by Osama Siblani, who is publisher and editor chief of the Arab American, based in Dearborn, Michigan. He is a Lebanese American, has been here for several decades. I wanted to ask, why did you come to the United States? Why did you move here from Lebanon?
I came here at the beginning of the Civil War to get education because of the universities were just actually closed because of the Civil War. So I came here in 1976. And my brother was here, and I stayed here. My brother went back, though, and I stayed here.
Now, you were vice president of
an international company, yes.
Of an international company, but you gave it all up to go into journalism.
That is correct.
And start this newspaper, The Arab American. Why?
Well, I started The Arab American News back in 1984, but I started really thinking about doing something in the media, you know, and paying back, you know, the world and my country, the United States, that at that time, and also my homeland, because of the Israeli invasion to Lebanon in 1982, and the silence and the propaganda and the spin, you know, that was put on this war. And it was personal because my own house in Beirut that I built for my mother, God bless her soul, she died 2 years ago. And I was the youngest in the family, so I had to build her a house, and the Israelis destroyed it and burned all my youth went in flame. I don't have anything from when I was young because our house was totally destroyed and everything was burned. And I took it personally, and also I thought that maybe America deserved a little bit of the truth, or at least the other side of the story that was not told. And I took it upon myself to start the process of putting some, of our opinion in the media. And that happened in 1984 on September 7th. We started the Arab American News, and we've been published weekly since then, mm-hmm. both languages.
Can you describe Arab America to us?
Well, Arab Americans are really they're not a monolithic society. They are from 22 Arab nations. Most of the Arab American community in here, however, are from, you know, a few countries. I would say number one, probably Lebanon. At this, still the top of the Arab American community are from Lebanon. Then Iraq. Most of the people here are from the Christian community. There are, of course, Palestinians from Jordanians and Syrians and Yemeni community. Very few Egyptians in Michigan, but in New York probably we have little more Egyptians than we have here. But basically this is the very few families from the Gulf region.
Why did Arab immigrants come to Michigan?
Basically, the reason that they came in at the turn of the 20th century is the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, is because of the auto industry. And it gathered, you know, a lot of Arabs from Lebanon in particular and the Syrian at that time. There was not Lebanon, there was the greater Syria. Came and immigrated to the United States, in particular to Detroit, to work in the auto industry. And then later they started going to Dearborn because Dearborn had a huge Ford Rouge plant. And they situated themselves in Dearborn and around the Dearborn area. And they, the family bonds, you know, that brought more families and brothers brought sisters and brothers and cousins and they started. Now they don't work in the auto industry. They have their own businesses and they are professionals. But that's why they came to Detroit, to the United States, and then to Detroit in particular and Dearborn most particular. Mm-hmm.
Talking about the media, you have a newspaper, mm-hmm. a weekly newspaper. Juan Cole, you do your blog on a regular basis every day, really collating Arab news from around the world. Before blogging was in style, how did you develop this approach to media and communications? Why did you get involved with it?
Well, I actually worked for a newspaper in Beirut in the late 70s, and I stuck it out longer than Osama did. I was there until 1979. And I finally gave up and decided to come to the United States for my education. Well, it was for the Monday Morning Company.
Oh, Monday Morning.
Which had an English language newspaper at the time.
Now the Daily Star, isn't it?
It's now the Daily Star. Mm-hmm. One of my jobs at the newspaper in Beirut in the late 70s was to read the Arabic wire services, put them in inverted pyramid form with the most important news first, as the Americans do it, and translate them into English. So I did that.
What, when, where, why?
Yes, that sort of thing. Well, they don't come that way. The Arabic wire services are like the French. You know, you might have a little meditation on the nature of human existence before you get to the news. I did that for about a year for many hours a day, and I learned to read Arabic news and skim it pretty quickly and also to think about how you would paraphrase it in English.
Where are you from originally?
I'm from a service family. I guess my family has roots in the Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, but I grew up all over the world in bases, France, Ethiopia, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I'm a rootless cosmopolitan in that way.
And so how did you turn that experience in Lebanon into blogging here in the United States?
Well, after September 11th, I had a similar experience to that of Osama after the Lebanese Civil War, is that I felt that a great many ignorant opinions were being expressed in our mass media by people who really couldn't even pronounce the names correctly and had no idea what they were talking about. And it annoyed me, having spent a long time in the region and having studied it professionally. And in the old days, before the rise of the internet, it was hard to get one's voice out. People think, well, an academic has some sort of special access, but no. I think a lot of journalists were convinced that academics can't write straight, and you should keep them away from the public if at all possible. So I couldn't get my op-eds published, and my credentials really meant nothing in the journalistic world. And it was only once I started keeping the weblog and commenting on al-Qaeda and the development of the war on terror, and then especially the Iraq war, that the journalists started reading me for information. And I often could get access through Arabic sources on the internet or in the media to a texture and a detail of information that wasn't available in the West.
And how did you come up with the title of your weblog, Informed Comment?
Well, it was a little bit of a joke at first because there were all of these very informed comments coming out of the mass media and the mainstream media, which are somewhat laughable. If you go back to the transcripts and read what people were saying, it's amazing the ignorance that was presented to the American public. So I was kind of joking around. I said, well, this is the informed comment. But unfortunately, now it's become popular and sounds maybe a little bit pompous, but that's all right.
I wanted to ask about the crackdown here at home when it comes to Arab Americans, Arab immigrants, but also on campus. You've been targeted, for example, and we're seeing this increasingly in universities around the country. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, there is obviously there has been for some time in the United States a lively set of culture wars, and I think there are people who are very disturbed by the way in which universities have resisted being taken over for ideological purposes. You know, most opinion in the United States that's presented on the media now, and this can be proven statistically, is coming out of think tanks. And what are think tanks? Some wealthy group of people endows these institutions and hires people to be in them, academic scholars often, but to present a particular ideological point of view. And of the 17 major think tanks, 15 are pretty far right. So the universities really have had an end run pulled on them. Their voices are much less heard in the mainstream. And I think there's frustration that they're still there at all, that there are professors who don't toe the party line, so to speak. And so there are various forces that are working to try to use congressional funding as a carrot to move universities in a particular ideological direction. There are campaigns of harassment. I, for instance, at one point was targeted to get 1,500 emails a day in order to cripple my activities on the internet. And people are blacklisted, they're libeled. I've been accused of being an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist because I objected to the Likud party policies of military occupation and colonization of the West Bank. So this is an ongoing campaign, and it's nothing new in American history. We have seen these things before, but it is very worrisome.
Osama Sablani, how does U.S. Patriot Act, but not only that act, affect activism in the Arab and Arab-American community? How is your newspaper affected? How are you?
Well, my newspaper is not affected, frankly speaking, because I really don't care what they're going to do. And I will continue to voice my opinion the same way I voiced them, even harder and more straightforward, because the situation calls for it. But I think in the general public, in the Arab American community, that have really destroyed our activism, and now we're trying to put them back together, and it's not easy at all. And it's ironic, you know, and shameful that we are, that this administration that claims that spreading democracy thousands of miles away from our country, while we're losing democracy here at home. And being harassing people because we disagree with them, politically. And that's happening in our community. I get every day complaints about a crackdown and about people who have been harassed. We have doctors that have, a couple of doctors have talked about how much they have been harassed directly because of their opinions. And because they have been associated with people like in Florida with Dr. Mazen Najjar or with Dr. Alarian, who is right now in court, his case in court, just because guilt by association. And how many people have been put in jail or turned away from the United States, and they broke families apart because of just guilt by association. And this have really almost put our community out of business as far as activism, because people are afraid. They could come and pick on you and say, you are from Hezbollah, or you are from supported Hamas, or you've done in your past donated $10 to that charity that supported that. I mean, now we can't even bring any help to the needy in our community because of the crackdown on charities. People don't know where to donate. When the tsunami disaster happened, we wanted to raise money, and we couldn't even get our community to donate to anybody because they would say, who are we going to donate to? And this is really a real, real problem in our community.
How hard hit is Dearborn? How many Arab Americans, how many Arabs are in Dearborn?
There are close to 35% of the town, which is about 35,000-36,000 in Dearborn. Most of them are from Lebanon. Iraqis are now being, considered a good portion of the community. But still the majority, the 90% of the population of Dearborn and the Arab community is Lebanese, mm-hmm. from the south of Lebanon.
Mayor in Dearborn?
The mayor of Dearborn, unfortunately, is a person that was elected in 1985 on an Arab anti-Arab platform. And he continues to be the mayor of the city until now, and he has never apologized for his nasty and racist remarks against this community.
And have many people been arrested in Dearborn? And is there a large FBI presence there?
There have been people arrested, and we really can't get you. I don't know. We still are trying to figure out how many people have been arrested. But most recently, a person was charged and convicted with, he had to make a settlement on associated with Hezbollah. When you look at the charges that have been mounted against several people, and they haven't been able to make it stick on one single individual in court, that of terrorism and stuff like this. The community is, of course, scared. But I can tell you from my experience, and I do this every day, and this is my full-time job, that our community is loyal community, and they never wanted to see anything happen to the United States because they ran away from trouble and from war and conflict. They want to live in peace, and they want to raise their children and give them education, and they don't want to see anything or harm, to the United States. But they are definitely scared.
Have you had trouble with your first name?
Yes, with Orrin Hatch, maybe. No, but with few people, but I've always maintained that I am older than Osama bin Laden. He's younger than me, so I couldn't be named after him, and he's probably named after me. And I will make good on my name. Actually, it's a good name, Osama. Osama means the lion, right? It's one of the names of the lion. And it's a very famous name and a very proud name in the history. And Osama bin Laden is not going to make it bad. I won't let him.
Well, Osama Sidlani, I want to thank you for being with us. Your website for listeners and viewers around the world?
www.arabamericannews.com.
And Juan Cole, professor at University of Michigan here in Ann Arbor, your website?
JuanCole.com, informed comment.
JuanCole.com. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks,
here
Nina.
In Ann Arbor. Thank you to Nina Rosenbaum of Daedalus Productions for providing footage from her new films, A Hero's Peace, about the March 11th bombings in Madrid. You can go to Daedalus.tv for more information. Thanks to our local production team here at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, Roger Sutton, Patrick Murphy, Jason Simpson, Scott Mann, Jeff Kale, Jerry McCarty. Also, thank you to Dennis Moynihan, David Goodman, Dari Goodman, our producers in New York, Mike Berkshire, Fabel Caduce, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Ryan Abernathy, and Mike DeFilippo. Yoruba Richin, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.